She's obviously not just a former slate mate of Brand New Congress with Jen. She is also a friend and somebody who would make a fantastic representative in our New York Congress. Rebecca Parson, welcome to Generational Change.
Hi, thanks for having me on. Nice to see you both again.
Hi. You know, I thought you had stepped away, so I was waiting for you to come back. It didn't occur to me that as soon as we said that, you'd come back on. So it's good to see you. Obviously, you're doing this again, yet again. So go ahead, tell people where your district is. I mean, I know Washington 5, but what that encompasses and, you know, a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I'm running in Washington 6th District, which is Tacoma and the Olympic Peninsula, the northwest corner of the state. And I'm running on the issues of hunger, homelessness, healthcare, and poverty. In this district, we have a lot of issues with people who don't have healthcare. They make too much to get the subsidies they need, and then they can't afford the healthcare. Also, housing up and down the whole West Coast, and especially here, is a really huge issue. And I'm a housing activist and organizer, so that's always been a, you know, top interest of mine. So yeah, those are some of the things I'm running on. My opponent is the 13th most conservative Democrat in the House. He joined with Republicans to sign on to a letter calling for Social Security cuts. He opposes Medicare for All and the Green New Deal, takes money from Chevron and Marathon Petroleum. So you get the idea. And our district's been blue for 56 years. So, and very progressive in the presidential primary. So we really are ready for more progressive representation.
Yeah.
Rebecca, would you say it's fair that Mr. Clymer was able to get through when he ran because he ran as a fake progressive and people were essentially hoodwinked, and that it really is time to have a true progressive who doesn't take the corporate special interest money?
That's what I've heard from his first run. You know, Kilmer presented himself as a progressive and said kind of what he needed to get elected. And so there are some progressives who feel still really betrayed. But he's definitely not a progressive. And he even, there was some anger among progressives in the district in 2016 because the whole district went for Bernie, but then he used a superdelegate vote for Hillary. So, and he last congressional term, he was chair of the New Democrat Coalition, which is the biggest coalition caucus of Democrats in the House. And it's just a very corporate kind of centrist to conservative Democratic faction. So he's very much with the establishment, the Pelosi wing of the party.
Yeah, one of the things that I think that is extremely a serious problem out where you are is the housing issue and what the homelessness situation must look like where you are. I mean, I know that you also there have income inequality issues, not necessarily as severe as Florida, but What is your current housing situation in terms of, can anybody there afford to live on the minimum wage?
No, definitely not. Our minimum wage is higher than the federal. It differs from place to place. It's usually about $12. Right. And people can't afford to live on it. Housing Tacoma, where I live, is actually the hottest housing market in the country, hottest meaning the shortest amount of time between when the house goes on the market when it's bought. And people are having to come in with, you know, all cash offers, 100,000, 200,000 above the offering price, you know, half a million is the median price. And this is not a wealthy district or community. You know, we don't, the Amazons and Microsofts, those are in Seattle. In this district, we have the one of the largest ports in North America. And then we have the Olympic Peninsula that used to be a big logging powerhouse and still does have some logging, but it's very much a working class district, and homelessness is on the rise. And the government from federal down to local level is just not doing enough about it. I actually, since the last election, have been focusing a lot on housing activism. And with a group of other people in a coalition, we occupied a building that had been a publicly owned building that had been empty for 12 years to demand they use it for housing. And we also paid for people to stay. Chris, my dog is she's having a hard time right now. Yeah, over Christmas we had people stay in a hotel and try to get the county to pay for it with the free COVID money. So FEMA, even since Trump, has been providing money for homeless people to stay in hotels because it's a COVID risk being out in the elements. And the county was just not using it. So we got people into a hotel and then tried to get the county to pay for it. And as a result of our activism, we got 200 shelter beds added in Tacoma. We got a so-called cold weather shelter, which means it's only open under certain extremes, you know, if very cold or very wet. We got that made 24/7, extended by 2 months. So, but those are, I mean, it's interesting as well to look at these kind of short-term things, but also, you know, the camp that we were working with and their they were members of our organization. You know, they directed us and were full participants in everything we did. And the camp where they are is literally on top of where there was a Hooverville in the 1920s in Tacoma in the port. And like when they dig in the ground, they turn up like glass, they found a glass Lysol bottle from the 20s. So it shows that these problems are very long-term with our entire system, where the entirely for-profit driven housing system, and whether or not people have somewhere to live is secondary, which is a big problem.
Yeah. I think the other thing we have in common, similarity, is our climate crisis vulnerability, being that we're both coastlines. I mean, obviously, there's different things that separate it, but you know, we recently just saw one of our buildings essentially crumble into the ocean from what is going to be saltwater intrusion when all comes down and it erodes at the concrete. And what kind of like effects from climate crisis are you seeing over on the other side of the country?
Oh, well, in the Pacific Northwest, we had that heat dome a few weeks ago. And something a lot of people don't realize is that most people here don't have air conditioning. Under a third of people have AC. So when it gets to 110 or in Portland, 115 degrees, we're just kind of boiling in that, where most of us don't have AC. So it's very dangerous for vulnerable people, people with disabilities, seniors, especially, you know, people of color who are more likely to be living in substandard housing. So it's very, very difficult to survive that type of weather. And then I have a lot of coastline, like you said, and there are tribes living whose their land is on the coastline. And, you know, they, of course, used to own much more than that, the entire peninsula. And so they've been pushed out to the corners and the edges of the peninsula. And now, having been pushed out there, they're having to come back in because the sea levels are rising. So they have to relocate and go, you know, mile upland, that kind of thing. And they have to create tsunami zones for their schools and like tsunami evacuation routes. So that's a big issue. And then also it made headlines recently because in Salish Sea, which is like here in British Columbia, marine animals were literally boiling to death, like the shellfish and mollusks and stuff, and the water was too hot, so they were literally heating to death. And we also have orca pods here. The salmon that they eat is not in, it's declining in supply, so they don't have enough to eat. That's partly due to climate change. Ocean acidification is impacting the orcas. I mean, there's all kinds of impacts from like human to environment, to animals, marine life. I mean, it's a big, big issue.
What is going to be the difference for you this time versus the first time? Obviously, name recognition is key, money is key, and obviously building stronger coalitions within the community is key. But what do you see being the difference this time around?
Well, I learned a lot, and I learned, you know, we did the best that we could with field. I'm really proud of what we did, but it was during the pandemic, so it was a lot of phone banking. And we made almost 1 million calls. It was over 900,000. And that was great. We had a lot of great conversations. A lot of people saying this was the first time a campaign had ever called them. But I couldn't afford TV and radio ads. And so when you compare, you know, somebody having maybe a couple conversations with the campaign to seeing my opponent's ads on cable news, on TV 30 times leading up to the election, you know, I need to be able to compete with that. So that means fundraising. So I started the campaign, announced it officially a month ago. And I've right now, from the beginning, focusing a lot on fundraising. I've got some really great people on, you know, Cori Bush's campaign manager. She's doing my fundraising, helping with call time. So that's a big thing. I'm doing a lot more call time. And for those who don't know, that's where candidates get like a list of possible donors. And then we just cold call them and ask them for money for hours a day. So I'm doing, that's, I would say, a big difference so that I can afford the things I need.
Yeah. My favorite thing to do is call time. You know that. I love call time.
Yeah, I was the one doing it, so. But that's a whole other story. Yeah, fundraising unfortunately is part of it, but you have to build the coalition. That's a very big part of it. And as long as we are continuing to network amongst each other and really hone in on the importance of building these coalitions. And one of the last things I want to cover, Rebecca, which I think is very important, is, you know, we are obviously, just like you, extremely strong advocates for Medicare for All. There is going to be the marches happening on July 24th, which is the following Saturday. We are going to be hosting a Medicare for All summit on Thursday, the 22nd, to really highlight not just Medicare for All, but obviously the marches. If you can talk about, because obviously there's been some issues with, you know, it's somewhat ragtag to begin with. But, you know, at the end of the day, this idea that we need to be waiting around for the perfect opportunity to support universal health care is, again, we don't have time. And I think we have to just take action. And if we take action, things are going to happen. So please tell us about what's happening, you know, in Seattle, how you're involved, and, you know, what we hope is, you know, a stepping stone, if you will, in regards to moving forward with universal health care.
Do you think, do you think that Seattle is the capital of Washington? Is that why you're saying that?
No, it's because Seattle is where they're having a march.
Okay, just checking. Okay, just checking your geography skills. Sorry.
So I'll be speaking at the march in Seattle, and I love that the marches are happening nationwide. You know, I think something to remember is 68,000 people die every year because they can't afford health insurance. And a lot of people have died of COVID specifically because they didn't have health care to treat their COVID. You know, people die because, you know, they make too much to qualify for subsidies, but they can't afford insulin. So diabetic, not taking insulin for years, then gets a heart attack. And so it's just critical. And we really need to try new stuff. You know, I think that's what I found with the direct action that I've been doing. You know, that was very different for Tacoma. People had not been doing housing direct action and occupying buildings. And so it was very new, and it was surprising, and they didn't really know what to make of it. And sometimes I would get a text from somebody saying, hey, you know, the city heard you're doing something this weekend, you know, just what exactly, you know, kind of nervous. Like, that's what you want. Yeah. Is for the people.
Yeah.
Like the people in power to wonder, oh God, what are they going to do this time? You know? And of course, peaceful, nonviolent, but, and so I think we have to try something new. As far as I know, I don't think there's been a nationwide march for universal healthcare before. Or if there has, it's been a while. So I think it's a good idea, and I'm excited about it.
Yeah.
Again, this is an issue. This is a unifying issue. You know, I don't want to take away from what other people have done in the past. Obviously, we have, you know, we had the tragedy down here at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, and there were a lot of people that were marching in the streets. But unfortunately, the gun issue is a very big dividing issue. It just is. And an issue like healthcare is an issue that affects everybody. You cannot avoid the issues of what exists in our country. You are in a much more unique position to push for universal healthcare than we are, because you are very close to Vancouver. You are very close to the Canadian border. And there are a lot of people that come in from Canada that I have no doubt either have family or friends, and they tell them that, yeah, healthcare is a hell of a lot better in our country than it is here. And the same is true for those that are stateside and that have a desire to just go to Canada to get, you know, 10% of the prescription drug costs, get 2 to 3 checkups per year for what is needed, or God forbid, have to go to the hospital and not worry about going bankrupt. I think this is a unifying issue, and the fact that you are stepping up to help lead the charge in Seattle.
Yeah.
And if there is an event in Olympia, you could do one there too.
Touche.
Yeah. I do want to, I want to give credit to the organizers, though. You know, whole Washington, Red Berets for Medicare for All. Like, they just invited me to come speak. Like, I could get the microphone for a couple of minutes, but, you know, they all did the hard work. I'm sure I'm leaving out the organization, so I'm sorry. But thank you to the organizers.
Got my hat. That's my hat from Fran. That's my hat from Fran from whole Washington. Yay!
If you ladies are watching, I'm a Red Beret too, and
hi to them. I like those ladies. I love those whole Washington ladies. I mean, I'm sure there's men in there too, but I've just met those ladies.
I can't do art to save my life, but I look
okay. You look ridiculous. You look absolutely ridiculous.
It's definitely not me, but
you don't wear it as me.
Yeah.
Well, how can people find you And I mean, I put up your website, but if there's anything else, like, other than, you know, whatever you need, I guess phone banking people, she's going to need phone bankers.
Text and money. Bankers, money. Canvassers.
Yeah, volunteers canvassers. And donations. Yeah.
Okay, guys, show some love.
RebeccaPerson.com. Oh, sorry. I think we're a little bit of a lag.
Go to RebeccaPerson.com
and you'll see how to sign up or follow me on Twitter at RebeccaForWA.com. And thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
No, always. And, you know, when's your election?
Next August. So I'm getting ready to start.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah, you're a late. You have a late one like we do.
Yeah. It's all good. We'll get you back on when you get like.
Absolutely.
When you get
closer. Yeah, we'll definitely. We'd let you know. We're going to be doing also because, again, it's still very early. But one of the plans that we do have, especially for 22, is to do a lot of candidate panels. You know, we want to have people, especially from brand new Congress. Mm-hmm. You know, we want to, you know, continue to pay it forward, if you will. And there's obviously a lot of great candidates on the slate, and you're certainly no exception. And we really appreciate you coming
on.
And
before you go, Rebecca, did you reach out to Catching Fire for the endorsement?
Is that, no, not yet. I will.
Okay. Yeah, do it. Cause that's the thing I'm on the board of that Ava started. Ava Putsova. Nice.
Yeah.
Check it out and submit your name.
Go to RebeccaParson.com. Check her out. She is definitely someone not to be underestimated, and especially in a state that really has a true progressive streak.
Yeah.
We certainly have your back, and you know, we will definitely have you back in the near future. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Thanks so much. Bye.
So anyway, obviously, as we know, there has been a massive amount of interest in this story that's coming out of Texas in regards to the walkout by the Texas Dems who are trying to protect voting rights. And we all know that there's a lot of teeth to these bills. But Representative Crockett, obviously, is she's an exceptional lady who has done an amazing job.
Badass,
as Jen would like
badass.
To say.
Badass.
But could definitely speak more to, because again, I don't really care what corporate media says because everything they say is distorted. I need to hear it from the actual representative who can tell you exactly what is in this bill that is going to hurt voters immensely. And it's going to hurt them if it passes.
Yeah, which again, it's all sorts of restrictions. It's nothing positive.
But it's also a testament to the GOP's refusal to change. They would rather just prevent you from voting in order to keep things the way they are. But we're not going to have that. So without further ado, we are going to welcome in the representative of the 100th district in the Lone Star State, Jasmine Crockett. Welcome to Generation Impact.
Hi, guys. How are y'all?
Hi. It's so nice to meet you. I was just watching you on the show yesterday, 2 days ago, and I texted him like, we got to get this girl. We got to get her on the show. And then I'm like, oh, she'll never respond. So then I called my friend Ina Minhares.
Yes.
And I'm like, okay, I could probably get Ina to come on. But then I knew that you were sort of leading this thing. So, and then you responded. I was so excited. So nice to meet you.
It's nice to meet you too. I apologize. We literally are just leaving a dinner with a congresswoman. And so I'm on a bus.
No, it's all good.
But I make sure I keep my headphones ready and my phone ready so that I can do whatever interviews I need to do. So thanks so much for doing this, you guys. Really powerful to have the type of platform that you have and to use it for good instead of bad. So I'm excited to join in on the
And people know I'm partial to Texas because I lived there for 6 years. My older son was born there. I was in San Antonio is where I went to law school. Wow. I'm St. Mary's. So, and I have a lot of friends there because of that. So I always have like an eye on what's going on in Texas, but talk a little bit about what was going on where you're like, you know what, this is what we're going to have to do to take a stand.
You know, it was a little different for me though. I think it was different for all the different members, but I'm a freshman. So this was a very abusive relationship that we had. In the 87th legislature. And I was just like, this is bad. Oh my God, this sucks. And so I finally got to the point that, on this last voting bill, it was kind of just the final straw. I think we all had been beaten down so much with the stupid bills. Everyone talks about like the voter suppression bill, but people don't understand that it was like the entire session was a suppression session, right? There were the attacks on trans kids. There were attacks on women's bodies. There were attacks as relates to doing anything smart with guns, even though we lead the country in mass shootings. You know, there were attacks on the homeless community, where they wanted to continually criminalize them, from setting up tents so that they would have shelter, to defecating and urinating in public. There were just nothing but like, it was nothing but an onslaught of attacks the entire session. And so we finally get to the very end, and it's voting rights. And it's the one thing that no matter what part of the state you come from, we all agree that this is the very democracy that we all depend upon. And it was just one step too far. The initial bill, SB 7, that we walked out on in May, included provisions such as you can just overturn an election, right? And you're an attorney. So to make it clear, you didn't have to actually prove that any fraud changed the results of the election. Let's say there was one person who did something wrong. That's enough to raise the issue and try to overturn the election, even though it wasn't a one vote election. And then what they wanted to do is they wanted to do a bit of forum shopping. So let's say it was an election in Dallas County, but I don't want to try this case in Dallas County. I want to go somewhere else where it's not so blue. They also wanted to lower the standard of proof. And so they wanted to say, hey, instead of it being clear and convincing evidence, we just want to use the preponderance standard. I mean, so everything that they could, but you had to understand that the author of the House bill, as well as the author of the Senate bill, they are both licensed attorneys who decided that they would use their time in going to try to overturn the election results in other states, such as Pennsylvania. So I'm guessing the impediments that they found in Pennsylvania, they decided, you know what, just in case we run into this situation ever in the state of Texas, we need to make this easier to do. As we know, that provision did not survive in the current versions that we have. In addition to Souls to the Polls attacks, that provision did not survive in the current version that we have. So most people say, hey, they took out the bad stuff. Nope, we still got 44 pages left to go, right? So to be clear, Texas is already the hardest state to vote in. And I keep telling people, we just want nice things like everybody else in the state of Texas. You know, there are 36 states plus D.C., that allow people to register to vote online. The state of Texas refuses to even have a hearing on an online voter registration bill.
Wow.
So when you talk about accessibility, when you talk about being reasonable, you guys have to understand that the laws that are already on the book in the state of Texas are already completely suppressive and regressive in the first place. That's one reason we have the lowest voter turnout in the country. That is not because Texans don't believe in voting, it's because Texans believe in suppressing the vote, or at least their elected officials believe in it. So seems like you may have a question, because I feel like I've been talking.
No, it's good. Look, I'm familiar with Texas. And because that's where I went to law school, a lot of what I learned was Texas. And I remember there in the beginning of talking about the Texas Constitution, that people were like, oh, don't even bother with that thing. That thing is like that. Nobody understands. Like, it's like this. It's ridiculous. Texas has a lot of weird things that people don't realize. So talk about when this strategy started coming together. Like, who thought of this? Like, how did that come about that you're like, you know what? The only way we're going to have power is to step out.
Yeah, no. Okay, so the first bill that we killed, there were only 2 hours left on the clock. It had been brewing for some time. I was kind of that rowdy freshman that was like, why are we sitting here as they're passing permitless carry, as they're restricting abortion and infringing upon women's bodies, as they are getting rid of local control as relates to cities and their budgets. Like, there was so much. And I was like, why are we sitting here? And so a senior member told me about quorum and told me, you know, this is what it takes and whatnot. And so I was like, I don't understand why we're not breaking this. Like, so for me, oh, let me get you some light.
It's all good. We're podcasting. A lot of people are audio anyway, but that's fine.
Okay. I guess I can't get the light. So that was kind of brewing for me over some time. I was quite frustrated At different points in time, there were different members that were trying to have different conversations about different bills, where they were like, we should just, you know, walk out on this bill. So we really got to about the Saturday before that Monday or Sunday, we got to that Saturday. And a number of us were like, yo, like, how many people are really down with, like, walking, right? And it was hard to kind of get a count. Like, can we get a count on this? And then there were just concerns about, well, if we walk, you know, and they bring us back, will they make it worse? They probably will make it worse. If we walk, you know, well, what will happen to my bills that maybe have made it to the governor's desk? Like, will he kill my bills? Like, there were just so many considerations that were going on. But we never could really get our hands on a count. And so finally on Sunday, you know, the time is like ticking, like the clock is just going and going. And this bill is about to be ready. The bill had to lay out for 24 hours. So it was coming up on the calendar, and we started to have, you know, a number of more meetings. There had been kind of like these silos of meetings. The core group that I was a part of was kind of part of kind of pushing the Black and Brown coalition to actually pull together. And it was the most epic thing. So we had these calls on Saturday. Gina Hinojosa had went ahead and found a Black church for us to go to if we did decide that we were going to walk on Sunday. We just wanted to have provisions in place. We were trying to figure out how much time was going to be on the clock. Would we have to really try to get outside the city limits? Like, there was just a lot of things like that we were kind of planning for, you know, as backups. And so ultimately, it was probably about, my times are all off, so I'm not even gonna give you times anymore. But at some point in time, there's this Black and Brown meeting that's called, and the speaker knows that we're having a hard time with this bill. And the speaker says, okay, you guys need to have a meeting. I'll just go ahead and put the house at ease at a certain time. And so we were all told, hey, when the house goes at ease, all Black and Brown people leave the floor. And we all, like, in mass, we left the floor. And like the Republicans were looking like, what's going on? Like, what are they doing? Are they coming back? Like, they didn't know, like, what was going on. And we had a conversation, and we were like, listen, if we're going to do this, we've got to know that we've got the numbers. It doesn't work if, like, five people leave. Like, it takes, like, all of us kind of working together. And so in that meeting, it became clear that, you know, the energy was kind of going in that direction. And so the whips were released so that they could go ahead and determine, hey, how many people are really in? And by the time we had another meeting with the speaker about this bill and how offensive it was and our concerns, we knew that we had the numbers. And so, you know, there were those that are so good at, you know, procedure, and they really wanted to procedurally do everything that they could to kill this bill. But with this being the governor's priority, I'm not even going to say a governor priority, but like the governor priority, I was thinking there's no way they're going to let us kill it. And so they had already gotten 25 signatures, which is what is required under the rules to make sure that you could actually stop debate on, like, you could call the question on any type of conversation debate that's going on the bill. So they went and got that done first thing in the morning. And so we knew that they were gonna call the question. And if they called the question and we were still there on the floor doing procedural things, we were screwed. Like, it was going to pass. They would have quorum. And it became evident that, you know, nothing on the floor was going to work. And so then after we had slowly been leaving, the rest of the members went ahead and they got out, and therefore breaking quorum. And so it was great. It was like really a short-lived victory, seemingly. because then the governor is like, ah, y'all ran away. I'm gonna take y'all pay. Like, what? You know, like, that was what he was on. And everybody's like, yeah, you know, quitters don't get paid. And I'm like, first of all, we walked out one day. Second of all, we already got that check. Like, stop it. And so, you know, he actually vetoed the legislative branch. Now, our money is guaranteed through the Constitution, but the branch itself, like, that allows us to actually function and be like an actual branch of government, like the clerks, the parliamentarians, anyone that works on the committees, like those that actually draft the bills, like he got rid of them and our staffers and all the Republicans and all of the Senate. Like he didn't like do something where it's like, oh, this is for Democrats only. Like that's not how it works, right? So he got rid of all of them. And so there's no funding until September. Well, the funding ends on September 1st. So he says, I'm calling them back in the special session. So he calls us back into special session. But now we know that he's mad, right? Like he's big mad. So if we're going to do anything, we're going to need to be prepared. We won't have 2 hours left on the clock to kill. It's going to be like days, if not the entire month. And so we didn't know when we would be called back in. We didn't know what exactly would be on the call. We didn't know exactly what their strategy was going to be. So we knew that we needed to be very flexible, but we needed to know how many people were willing to make a sacrifice of up to 30 days to be away from their family. And we had the numbers. We had enough people that were willing to make the sacrifice if it came down to it. So
how many people walked out, Jasmine?
We have everybody except for 4, so 63.
That's awesome. And yeah, you only needed, and you needed how many?
51.
That's awesome. That's like the coolest. This is what we're talking about, people. This is
they say that Texas has the biggest balls in the country. I guess that goes for both political parties.
Everything's bigger in Texas.
Everything.
Well, don't mess with Texas. You know, I'm curious. Again, this is a very hot button issue. There are, you know, arguments on both sides as to what type of voting rights or even restrictions for that matter. It shouldn't be restrictions, but nevertheless, a lot of people seem to think there should be. What would you say are the primary components of this bill that is basically a non-starter as far as you're concerned? And it's a complete, what you would call, you know, Texas GOP special, if you will.
Oh, that have to be the voter intimidation portion of this bill. That really is the part that I really don't think is really being communicated very well. This bill wants to embolden and empower partisan poll watchers. A lot of those guys that most likely showed up to the insurrection. So in essence,
you know, kind of like with the, you know, with the MAGA brigade that tried to run the bus off the road.
Yeah.
What this bill will allow is for, if you're a supporter of the GOP, and we know as of right now, the GOP has a pretty big stronghold in the state. So if they were to vote somewhere, you know, in the Austin metro area, Dallas, Houston, wherever, you know, you could show up more or less in your complete MAGA brigade and stand right by the polling doors, almost as if to basically say, just remember, we're going to be watching you when you go in there to vote, and we're going to know if you're on our side or not.
It's worse than that. It's worse than that.
Please share.
So what the bill allows for is I send poll watchers. Most candidates send poll watchers to make sure that things in a polling location are functioning like they're supposed to. You know, the simple things. Like, for instance, the one rule that everybody knows, if you're in line by the time that the polls close, then you're good to go, right? Like, making sure that people aren't disenfranchised because they're turned away and it's like, oh, you didn't make it inside the building even though you were in line. You know, they make sure that, because that's something you can't fix later, right? Like, you can't fix that after somebody's left because someone sent them away, giving them the wrong information. So we always send poll watchers. Our poll watchers for my campaign normally will call us or call down to the elections administrator if there's a concern or question about any irregularities, maybe take notes of any irregularities. So that they can be resolved in real time. Well, most of the time the candidates train their poll watchers, but usually the poll watchers kind of just, they're just observers. It's like an election observer. What we did in Texas is they passed permitless carry. So number one, people will be allowed to have guns, okay? Okay, so add that.
That sounds about right for Texas.
Add that to fact that you've got these partisan poll watchers who are mainly going to go into, by their own admission, because we have this recording of this group that is outside of Harris County that wanted to go down into the city, the urban area, and make sure that they can watch what they're doing. There's no parameters on how closely a partisan poll watcher can get to an actual voter. There's language in there that says that they have to be able to hear what's going on. So we're threatening, number one, the secrecy of the ballot. Number two, the intimidation factor that is built into this. Like, this is completely done for the purpose of intimidating. There is no, and on top of that, the person that normally runs the polling location is the election judge, which is usually some little sweet little old man or old woman that has been doing this forever, right? They're basically stripping them of any power to control their polling location. The partisan poll watcher has more power than they do. Normally, an election judge would be able to have someone removed if there's some issues. They're not allowed to do that under this. And election judges are trained in the election law before they're allowed to even serve. These partisan poll watchers do not have to go through any training whatsoever. So you could essentially have this debate and ongoing kind of fight with the partisan poll watcher and the election judge. The previous version of this bill also allowed them to be able to do recordings. We're not even allowed to have our own phone out and take a picture of our own ballot, right? But they were going to allow these guys to do recordings, which yet again could be intimidating to a voter and definitely turn them off and turn them away from the ballot box. And I absolutely believe that that's the intent, because partisan poll watchers, they're not the police. Like, I don't understand, like why are we doing all of this? So that's one piece that I don't really feel like people understand is part of this bill. Another thing for me that is quite offensive, as a civil rights lawyer, as a criminal defense attorney, is this idea of just over criminalization. You know, they call things voter fraud. Most of the time they're voter mistakes, right? And I don't know if they're even really mistakes so much as it is a lack of education of what the law is, right? Most of the time when we think about someone committing something criminal, we think of them as having some nefarious intent of some sort. That's not required in the majority of these provisions in this bill. And one of the crazy things is they were so upset with Harris County, because Harris County basically had a bunch of millennial elected officials.
Just for people who don't know, Harris County is Houston. Or yes, Houston is in Harris County. I'm just giving, because Texas is big, I'm giving a frame of reference. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
Yeah.
So basically, if an elected official sends out a vote by mail application to someone who qualifies to vote by mail, if they do that under this bill, that elected official has now committed a crime and they are to go to jail. Why would that be criminal?
I don't understand.
To send out a vote by mail application.
How else are they supposed to just come in themselves and get it?
They have to figure it out on their own. You cannot assist anybody in getting a vote by mail application.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So you can see that it's all about the restrictions. And so, you know, even they're saying, oh, we expanded access to the ballot box. Go ahead, Carl. We expanded access to the ballot box because we're providing for more hours than historically have been provided for in this bill. Well, most states do a minimum standard when it comes to the number of hours that polling locations must be open. But what I liken it to, there's never been a maximum. Now they want a maximum number of hours. So with them requiring a maximum number of hours, they're actually suppressing the vote again. So I was like the party chair, Democratic Party chair in Texarkana, which is East Texas, small town. I never, ever would have wanted 24-hour voting in East Texas. There just wouldn't have been the demand for it. We're just kind of a smaller area. But it's the same thing that, like, we didn't have that many restaurants that stayed open 24 hours a day in Texarkana either. But if you go to Houston, right, you'll have a number of restaurants that stay open 24 hours because the demand is there. And so this idea of taking away local control has been, that was also another theme this session, was the locals are not smart enough to handle their own counties. Historically, Republicans have always said that they are the party of small government.
Yeah.
And local control matters. And so what I've decided is the locals can control it so long as the locals are Republicans. But as soon as the locals aren't Republicans, then we need Big Brother to come and talk to us. And so that's exactly what they did. Literally, we had a ton of bills that were bracketed to only affect our largest counties, which happen to be democratically controlled. They're trying to tie their hands. And they're also trying to do everything that they can to make sure that they hopefully lose in their next elections. When we talk about our attorney general, who wants to go out and prosecute everybody, and the most that he was able to even bring cases on in a number of years, it was the testimony was that there were 44 cases. And the majority of those 44 cases were actually mistakes. They weren't real cases of voter fraud. But I can tell you what was real and what is real. The 700 people that died this year in our winter storm because we don't have a functioning grid. I can tell you about the tens of thousands of people that died from COVID-19 because we had a lack of leadership coming out of the governor's mansion. So to me,
your lieutenant governor should be charged as an accessory to murder, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, all of them should be. But our attorney general, which is where I started this, our attorney general actually went as far as saying on TV, which I'm like, I can't wait for the litigation over whatever voting nonsense we get. He goes, yeah, I had to stop them from sending out those vote by mail applications, because if I hadn't, Trump would have lost the election.
Oh, man.
That's what he said. So we know what the demographics in the state of Texas are. We know in the last 10 years, the growth has been Black, Brown, and Asian. 80% of it has been that. Our demographics in the state of Texas really almost mirror the demographics in the state of California. We are crazy diverse.
Yeah.
The problem is we don't have access to the ballot box. We don't have access for the everyday person or the poor person, or, you know, we want to make all of these complications. So I know that the naysayers are like, voter ID, it should be the law everywhere, blah, blah, blah. You know, and I tell them we have voter ID in the state of Texas. So, like, stop it. And we got in trouble for it as well, right? Texas passed strict voter ID. And we needed a court that would say, Texas, that was intentionally discriminatory, yet again, because that's what y'all like to do. And so there had to be some sort of safety valve. So people have the ability to fill out an affidavit explaining why they don't have an ID and still be afforded an opportunity to vote. So now in this new bill, when it comes to vote by mail, they want to make you do voter ID as well. And let me tell you, I don't understand all the ballot by mail provisions in here. I can guarantee you nobody really understands all the ballot by mail provisions in here.
They don't want you to understand.
No. It was completely intentional, because we've had, I don't know how many briefings, right? And I'm talking about, we've got the elections administrators coming in, and like, these are the people that do this. Like, there's a letter from all these like small town Republican areas, and like the elections administrators are like, yeah, no, so this is bad, this is bad, this is bad. And then they're like, we don't even know what this means. Like, this is what's coming out from the like elected officials that will have to follow this. And so there's this, I'll make it as plain as I can. The bill would require a ton of your personal information to be on the outside of the ballot, to the extent that elderly persons would be subjected to identity theft, which is a real thing.
Yes.
I can tell you that. That's a real thing. As a criminal defense attorney, I can tell you that's a real thing.
Yeah.
Because they want, like, not your social security number. It's like you got to put some, it's weird. And then something about where you sign, it's got to be where the they were like, we don't even know how they're going to put this they literally were like, we don't know how we would open this ballot to confirm the information that we need to confirm without potentially, you know, getting rid of the secrecy that is supposed to be provided for in the ballot. So it's a lot of drama. I don't know what they don't know what they did. I'm sure the Heritage people did it for them. So, you know,
that sounds right.
The Heritage Foundation, definitely. If you think they're big in Texas, they've got a very nice building in D.C.
Oh, gosh. Jasmine,
one thing that I do want to cover, which I think is very important, is obviously there's a huge gubernatorial election coming up next year. I'd like to know from your perspective, you know, the Texas Democrats are definitely trying to set precedent for the rest of the country, at least in the states that are either red or swing. And so in the case of yours, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of rumblings about, you know, Beto running for governor. But I do think it's important to really talk about the importance of not just one election, but what the future can represent. We recently had Julie Oliver and Mike Siegel from Ground Game Texas on, and they really talked about the importance of building that foundation in Texas, because it definitely can be done. There's a lot of voters to be had. Like you said, a lot of the reason why the GOP has been dominant for so long are these voter suppressive methods. So I'm curious, in terms of the leadership and the goals of the Texas Democrats, you know, what do you guys foresee as being more or less the short and the long-term strategy? And is there, much like the way that the non-corporate progressives took over Nevada's Democratic Party, are there a lot of things that people can learn from the Texas Democrats that they can incorporate within their state party?
Yeah, okay. So short goal, obviously, right now is federal oversight. That's the easy one, right? Because Texas always has to be told you're bad. So, you know, that's obviously the short goal. The long goal to me, though, has to be one that says we'll do whatever we've got to do to get over this. And so I'm glad that you brought up Mike and Julie. They are absolutely amazing. I am completely on board. I actually sit on their advisory board.
Did not know that.
We didn't even know that.
I thought that was a little plug. Yeah, no. So I am. I'm actually myself and James Tallarico, right? Go figure. So, you know, we are, sadly enough, we're doing this over here right now. But when we get back, I'm a grassroots girl. You know, I won my election by 90 votes. I was the girl that was outspent 5-1. I was out endorsed. When I say out endorsed, I didn't really have any endorsements. I mean, and I'm talking about Congress people, everybody came out to support my opponent. But I would never be outworked. And I did what no one thought could be done. And then I ended up being the only newly elected Black freshman this year. And where most people probably thought this probably isn't the best space for you, you probably don't have like room to grow and spread your wings. I have been very aggressive. I didn't like the fact that.
I hate that, by the way, when people like, if that's that sort of you needed to wait your turn mentality.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yep.
And it is something that it drives me insane. That's called a monarchy, not a democracy. So, yep. You know, exactly.
Yep.
Go ahead.
I was just saying that I believe in the power of the people. I'm a testament of the power of the people. And so, you know, if I can avoid an opponent, which I probably won't just because people love to just run for office, that's fine. It's a democracy. I think they're hard pressed to beat me, but you know, whatever, bring it on. But if I could avoid an opponent, my only goal would be in getting around this state, getting into places like Texarkana, where I was the chair of the Democratic Party. Like, I can talk the lingo in East Texas, Longview, Tyler, Texarkana, Marshall.
That's a whole other world for people watching this. That's like when people think of Texas or they think of Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, and Austin. I'm like, no. When you get outside of the perimeter of that, it's a whole different thing. And Texas could be like 5 states. East Texas to me might as well be Louisiana.
Oh yeah, no, it's crazy. But you know, I want to get out. I want to. You know, I think one of the things that we've done, if we don't do anything else with us breaking quorum, is we've, number one, brought attention to the fact that the GOP will stop at nothing. And so for those that believe that their votes don't count, well, why would they be doing all of this? You know, like, why would you go this far?
Exactly.
You wouldn't go this far if people's votes didn't count. So I think that, you know, we get to take control of the rhetoric, number one, and say, hey, your votes do count. Number two, don't you want to show them up and show them that they really should have just been nice people and let us have nice things Don't you want to just go ahead and get rid of them? Our numbers are tight. You know, years ago, people kept saying we're going to flip Texas. And I'm like, y'all, we ain't flipping nothing, right? Now I'm like one of those, we're going to flip Texas, right? And I believe that the Republicans believe that because they wouldn't be fighting so hard. This would not be a reason to call a special session, right? The governor is not going to give up until he gets some more suppression on the books because he doesn't know how else he can win. It is a scary fact that their most popular guy, right, Donald Trump, he only won the big red state of Texas by about a little bit over 5 points. That is scary when you go back and you say, if we just go back two presidential cycles, there were double digit leads for
but
the
Republicans. But I totally won Texas twice. Oh, I totally won it twice. I won it twice. Big time. Really great. Really incredible. And you're just a little freshman representative. You're totally not on my level yet. Wait your turn.
Okay. So at the risk of me feeling exceptionally old, what year did you graduate law school?
2006.
Okay, that's not that old, okay? I was 2000, so it's not that bad. I mean, like, oftentimes it'll be like a 20-year difference, and I'm like, yeah, that's not good. Because a friend of mine from St. Mary's actually transferred over to Houston. Yeah, but long before you. It was still long before you were there.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, this has been a wonderful conversation, but we would probably be remiss to not ask you what the experience has been like going to D.C.
How long do you have to stay out? That's the other thing. Like, how long are you committed to being there?
So our 30 days will end on August the 7th. On August the 7th, we would have effectively killed both of these bills. The governor can call another special session, and he has to start all the way over.
They've got and what happens over. When you go back?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to jail, though.
All that they could really do is force you to stay in chambers until it gets done. Like, I think that's the scope of the authority. I don't think that there's anything criminal. I think it's more like a civil contempt thing than it is. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong.
You're not wrong.
Okay.
You're not wrong, but... You know, when you have a governor that wants to just lie to people, I'm like, y'all should just vote him out for being a liar.
But again, I say this every time he comes up, I voted against him when he ran for attorney general. I would have never imagined that he would be. He's disgusting, and I've never liked him. So
listen, I mean, you wouldn't think that this guy was a lawyer, let alone a former Supreme Court justice.
Oh, yes.
Let alone an attorney general. And then says stupid stuff like, I'm going to lock him up. First of all, you ain't got no authority. None at all. Like, we could start there. You're not the one. The Speaker of the House is the one that would, you know, put the call on the House, which the call has been put on the House. And, you know, our sweet little sergeants. I mean, you guys can go watch a video. That's the other thing. I'm like, I really wish I had the time or energy or desire to post on his Twitter and be like, so this is what you meant. Because they, like, came, they read a piece of paper. They're like, is your member here? Okay, well, by the authority that I have, blah, 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 please let your member know that we want them back. Like, it was like this formality or whatever. And I'm like, guys, you guys know where we are. Like, we haven't been shy about it. We're in D.C. and y'all can't do nothing about it. And, like, you know, these headlines back home, they're like, oh, the fugitive legislators. I'm like, I'm not a fugitive. Like, what are you talking about? Like, it's just overkill, right? Like, he's so dramatic. And, you know, I'm just like, so you thought it worked for Trump, so you think that it's going to work for you? Okay. Like, whatever. No. Just lie to the people. So he's actually, I think, been called out a couple of times. I'm like, that's got to feel really bad to have, like, the little black girl freshman be, like, who Fox News is asking you about when she's made, like, a comment. So I've said
that's got to be harsh for him, man. That's got to be bad.
Like,
that's going to leave a mark.
Yeah, because I'm, like, on CNN. They're like, are you going to jail? I'm like, no. And, you know, they're like, oh, okay. Like, no, I'm not. Sorry, didn't commit a crime. It's kind of unconstitutional. So if you lock me up, you're going to have a whole other issue on your hands.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the reality is the GOP, especially in a state like Texas, always plays offense. They never have to play defense. And a lot of that just has to do with the way the infrastructure has been for, you know, the party for a very long time on the Democratic side. But with leaders like yourself, Jasmine, it seems to me that the needle is moving.
I think we lost her.
So as a lot of you may know, the Assange case, although maybe you don't know, the Assange case is actually falling apart, which is a great thing.
The Assange case never really existed except in the fantasy land wherein it was made up to exist. So I'm just saying.
It's not something that could be sold through corporate media the way it used to be. Correct. And so now we're going to have the opportunity to speak with Kevin about this issue, because there's certainly a lot going on here that I'm not sure everybody realizes. And that also includes this. We're going to let Australia take over now. So without further ado, Kevin, welcome back to Generational Change.
Hi, Kevin.
Thrilled to have you. And the floor is yours, brother.
It's good to talk to you both. I mean, where to start? There's so much to say. Is there anything specific into?
Yeah, let's go back to, for people who don't know, just a quick update. We talked about it briefly last week, that the key witness in this case against Julian has since come forward and retracted his statement. And so then the question becomes, okay, now what? So I think like from that point on, I mean, look, we've known that this case is bogus all along, but as this has unfolded, where does the case stand now?
Yeah, so to this witness, which has been something that is significant, one of the reasons it's confusing for people is because the indictment in which Ziggy Tordarson is referenced was actually not widely reported in the press. So people don't fully understand what happened. And it's also a tad bit unusual the way the Justice Department prosecutors went about adding him into the indictment. And they added him into the indictment, let me put it this way. They sourced allegations that they said were from him. And they did this like 7-8 weeks before the extradition trial, totally blindsiding Assange's legal team. They weren't prepared. They didn't have time to prepare witnesses for the extradition trial. In fact, the first day of the extradition trial, as I covered it, was spent telling the judge she needed to throw out all these new allegations that were put in the indictment because there wasn't proper notice given. And it was not fair to the accused to throw this in. There's a process to follow. It wasn't in the original extradition request packet, and all of a sudden they're springing these new allegations. It's not linked to any new charge. What they did is they were window dressing their computer crime conspiracy charge that has no basis at all. And the computer crime conspiracy charge is important to them because without it, then they are just prosecuting journalism. So they need the public to believe that Julian Assange is not a journalist and he's a hacker. That's what they're selling us through this third-rate prosecution that they're perpetrating on all of us. And they need us to believe this. So they go to this guy. Ziggy is someone, I don't know how much you've talked about him.
We don't know a lot about this particular witness. We don't. Yeah, please.
Guy, I mean, this guy is as dirty as dirty gets.
Yeah.
Well, so this is what I mean about like people didn't do the basic reporting on the indictment, and had they would have seen that there was a mention of a teenager one in the indictment, and it would have raised interest in the same way I was actually interested in this new indictment that there were alleged co-conspirators mentioned in the indictment, suggesting that the Justice Department has looked closely at people other than Julian Assange and contemplated cases against other staff members of WikiLeaks. We'll leave that for another conversation. So Ziggy is somebody who was a volunteer for WikiLeaks at one time when he was like 17 or 18 years old in Iceland. But he didn't really do a whole lot, and he spent his time inflating his importance. And essentially, he embezzled $50,000 from the WikiLeaks store and was prosecuted for it in Iceland. He's been charged with several crimes, But what's fascinating to me and what you may not know is that the reason why we got this story about Ziggy recanting and saying that he no longer stood behind allegations that basically involve the suggestion that Julian Assange was trying to get him to help hack into Icelandic institutions of government and banking agencies, etc. I've lost my train of thought. The journalist who worked on this, Bjartmar Andresen, really good work. Talked to Ziggy for about 9 hours. The whole story started with the fact that he is apparently involved in these con artist schemes in Iceland, where he is buying products and then he's essentially like extorting companies for money and selling them products back to them. He's been accused of serious crimes in Iceland. He is also someone who's been convicted multiple times of sex with underage boys. In fact, I understand that one of the one of the minors who made allegations did not make it into a case that was brought by Iceland, and it was so devastating that that young person committed suicide because they were not going to have their day in court to raise their claims against Ziggy. So this is the kind of damage that he's doing. He's a diagnosed sociopath, and I'm not just saying that in order to smear him. It's the process in Iceland, different from the United States, is you go through a mental evaluation, and if you're diagnosed as having sociopathy or psychopathy or however they term it, then you do not get a prison sentence. They deal with you differently. And so Ziggy has not gone to prison, and he's just convicted of all these crimes, and they continue to have crimes that they can bring against Ziggy Tordarsen. He has this deal with the U.S. Justice Department or the FBI. It's an immunity deal. Whatever he tells the FBI, they're not going to pass it on to Iceland. And that's really important because Iceland actually kicked the FBI out of its country because somewhat connected to what we're just talking about here. They mentioned that there was a cyber intrusion against Iceland, and Iceland didn't have the resources or doesn't have a whole lot of law enforcement resources. The FBI said, hey, we could come to Iceland. We could help you out. Let us come there and we'll investigate. Once they got there, Iceland slowly figured out, or a minister slowly figured out, that they weren't investigating this cyber attack. In fact, they were just trying to collect intelligence and evidence against Julian Assange to prosecute Julian Assange and to go after WikiLeaks. So they got kicked out. They were told that they were no longer allowed to be in Iceland. And they didn't leave right away, but a week later, they finally relented and left the country because they were unwelcome guests. So this to me speaks to the massive corruption that we have within the case. That's its significance to me. It's not significant so much because of the charge that it is with, because there's no single charge that Ziggy didn't lead the Justice Department to indict Julian Assange on additional charges. It just was added in, and actually doesn't make a whole lot of sense that it was added in there.
I was going to say that to you. It's sort of like they went and added this in to show basically a pattern of behavior for Assange. So it's not the exact case itself. So the case itself is having to do with the case with Chelsea Manning. And then this was sort of added in as, oh yeah, by the way, this goes to a pattern of behavior is why they allowed it. But what's interesting is that normally one additional incident does not a pattern of behavior make in terms of being allowed to be admitted as evidence. But what's so interesting is that they picked this guy with the credibility of crap to be this additional like story against Julian and not even relative to the main case. So this is something, and I know this probably sounds crazy, but to me, what this says that this is current right now is that this is almost the way for the Justice Department to gracefully bow out of this and not have egg on their face and have it be like, okay, yeah, we just didn't have a good witness. And so maybe this is a good sign that all of this is being public now. I mean, what do you, you know, is that crazy talk?
Well, so to me, this is the only part of the indictment that is original Trump Justice Department work. Everything else in the indictment, you can trace back to Eric Holder's Justice Department.
Right.
And you can say that this is evidence and this is investigative work that was done under a pre, I've always taken, and I believe you both probably take it too, that all of this work had always been done with the intent of destroying WikiLeaks as a media organization. That's there was the political intent behind it, we could not allow this organization to exist as a challenger of U.S. power, and so they did all that work, but as is common in these conversations, and as you've heard before, they got to that New York Times problem. They recognized that they could not defend it in public. It's kind of like something Daniel Ellsberg says about information and transparency and how basically if you don't want leaks to inflict so much damage upon you, then you should stop doing those things in secret that you can't defend out in the open. Well, the same here is it's like, you know, this prosecution is something that they were doing and they were putting it together and they've been piecing it. And as people have become more knowledgeable about it and are aware of what's going on with prosecutors, none of them can defend it. Actually, you can't get a single Biden administration official to defend this case. You can't get Secretary of State Antony Blinken to answer questions from foreign journalists who are questioning him while he's out in various countries doing his work. They don't want to talk about it.
You mean President Blinken? Sorry, I can't help it. He's really the president. He just is. But I am curious because one of the biggest reasons why this case has been allowed to fester has been the silence of corporate media and their refusal to even address this. I have particular ire for Jim Acosta, among other people, because if you remember when he was questioned about it, he wouldn't even address it. He basically was sheepish, trying to peddle a book about the integrity of the press. And when he was actually asked a question about real press integrity, he's like, yeah, I don't think I can answer that. Well, actually, the people who pay you don't want you to. That's what it's about. So I do think that corporate media plays a big role. How big a role do you think they play?
Yeah, so I have a complicated answer to this, just because of the way the media ecosystem works. You know, on one hand, I benefit because corporate media doesn't want to have anything to do with this case, and they're not interested. Julian Assange loses out because they won't take it seriously and go beyond the editorial pronouncements that they put out. You know, so just to be clear here, these corporate outlets that we're talking about, all of them have, for the most part, editors in chief who have come out and said, we oppose this prosecution. The problem is that they're not doing work on this case. They're not investigating it. They're not producing articles like Stundin in Iceland or El País in Spain did a fantastic series of articles on UC Global, the private security contractor that was accused of spying on Julian Assange while he was in the Ecuador embassy, targeting his legal team. There's a whole Spanish case that continues to unfold there, which you don't hear about at all in the press. In fact, what happened is, and this is actually referenced in the extradition decision, and it came up in the extradition trial, What you hear instead is that CNN took these materials that showed spying on a journalist and his legal team and people who were visiting him, excuse me, and they wrote an article for their website and to air about how this all confirms that Julian Assange is tied to Russia and all of that, which is not what El País took away from the materials. They took something completely different. They took away the news we needed to know, and they told us why it was crucial, because they were taking videos of him while he was living in the embassy, violating his privacy, highly intrusive. And it was all part of a pressure campaign to push him out of the Ecuador embassy. So you don't get this reporting. And when they do cover it, what they're doing is publishing columns or op-eds like WikiLeaks is not whistleblowing or WikiLeaks is not journalism. And with that, they're actually undermining their editor-in-chief's own pronouncements against the case, because you're actually laying down a foundation, you're creating a climate that makes it easier for the prosecutors to bring this case. You're making it easier for them to get away with going to the United Kingdom and asking the UK to extradite Julian Assange to the United States. And so that's their role, is basically that they become complicit in this case, because what they're choosing to publish is not information that educates us on the case. In fact, one of the complaints of well-known personality Katie Halper about what happened with the coverage of the Assange appeal is that the New York Times went ahead and made the headline up. He's going to get transferred to Australia if he comes to the U.S. So nothing to worry about here. I mean, hey, you were concerned he was going to be tortured and abused in a U.S. prison. We solved it. He's just going to go to Australia to serve a sentence. So everyone just quit getting worked up about the show, which is nuts. It's absolutely insane, because what the U.S. is actually admitting is that the U.S. prison system is so cruel and inhumane that it cannot extradite even criminals that are supposed to be extradited to the United States and put them in prison.
Right.
The actual real terrorists who we want to bring to justice, let's say hypothetically there's someone, they attacked and killed U.S. soldiers and you need to extradite them from the U.K. You can't, because they cannot prove that that person would not be tortured and treated inhumanely in a prison. So you can't just, oh, hey, we solved it, he's going to Australia. No. I mean, Amnesty International is not buying it. They put out a really good statement saying why we shouldn't accept these assurances.
Kevin, can you talk about the danger of throwing the words like treason around and,
I love that. People have no idea what it means. None whatsoever.
Yeah.
Everything is treason if it's against your country. And it's like, no, there's actually very specific rules about that. So, yeah.
And the danger of it too, and this is the whole thing, because again, people won't keep Trump out of their mouths because it makes them money. That's it. Anyone who can't read the writing at this point, that the only reason Trump still gets talked about ad nauseum is because he gets clicks. That's it. So I think it's very important for people to understand just how dangerous, this whole case is dangerous. This is a case that will be talked about long after we've left this earth. It's going to set precedent for a long time, and God willing, it'll end the right way. But if you could talk about just the danger of evoking such terms like treason when it comes to something like this and what that means.
Yeah. So just to make sure we come back to the fact that we started this conversation about it all falling apart. It's important to remind people along the way that Julian Assange is winning. I mean, it doesn't feel like winning because he isn't in prison, but I always, as I make my remarks about things that are extremely bleak, I always remind people that, he's actually in a better position because he's not appealing he's not appealing that the judge authorized the extradition to the United States, which would be, I think, at a much, much worse place for the Assange legal team. So you may not know this, but this is actually really interesting. Chelsea Manning, when she was charged, faced an aiding the enemy offense. This goes to your question about treason and everything. Yeah. So she was charged with aiding the enemy in addition to the Espionage Act offenses. And what it amounted to is part of it, the military prosecutor said, when the raid against Osama bin Laden's compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan was conducted, we went in and we pulled out all these drives and left with these materials. And when we went through these hard drives, we found copies of WikiLeaks documents. So Osama bin Laden had asked for some WikiLeaks documents because he wanted to read about them as it applied to what he was doing on the battlefield. And so this was what they tried to sell to the judge. And in fact, Chelsea Manning was acquitted of the aiding the enemy offense, was not found guilty. And yet this was recycled. It's actually in Julian Assange's indictment. This narrative that is ludicrous because clearly Osama bin Laden, his deputy, bin Laden deputy, just went online like us and found the documents. There was nothing, you know, they don't give you evidence that she emailed someone in bin Laden's circle copies of these documents. They just say that somebody who's a terrorist downloaded documents that are available to every person in the entire world. And that's just to illustrate that we actually don't have anything to substantiate this idea that Chelsea Manning was a traitor. And since basically they're saying that Julian Assange is a co-conspirator, then he can't actually be found guilty of being a traitor either, because there's no evidence that either of them engaged in treason. But then, you know, let's talk about this culturally and politically. The idea that Julian Assange did was treason. I mean, first off, he's not a U.S. citizen, so he doesn't owe this country anything. He can do whatever he wants, which means that he can choose whatever politician he wants to support. And yeah. and he doesn't have to play the two-party politics game that we have to play as citizens. And if he wants to make a calculated decision that in the end backfires, and quite clearly, I'm sure he's had time to think about it, about how he was wrong. But if he wants to say that I think it's more likely in 2016 that Hillary Clinton will jail me than Donald Trump, then he can do that because he's not a U.S. citizen. And
Hillary Clinton didn't want to jail Julian Assange. She wanted to drone bomb him, and there is record of that. So I'm just saying, usually if a person says, can't we just kill this guy? Yeah, I'm probably more inclined to take anybody else who's not going to make a statement like that. But again, and I monitor Jen's social media very closely, and I got to tell you, it seems that even, you know, the good news is that when you have a good reputation, it doesn't get very aggressive in the sense that people just think that you're just aiding the enemy. But what I have noticed is that overwhelmingly, you know, if Jen is supporting Julian on social media, the dissent is always, well, he helped Trump. That's their excuse. Every time. There's nothing else. Yeah. Wow. He helped Trump, and I just can't accept that. And I'm just thinking, even if he did help Trump, he's a journalist. He's a journalist. That they're allowed to help whoever they want to help as long as it's not breaking the law. I mean, I don't know.
He didn't help Trump. Hillary Clinton helped Trump. Okay. Julian Assange just exposed it. So I'm so tired of this shoot the messenger thing. We do it with everything. It's absolutely absurd. And the treatment, and this is for all whistleblowers. This is the same stuff that was happening in Amazon when Chris Smalls complained about the conditions. He gets fired. So this is always shooting the messenger. Julian Assange is a hero. We should be building monuments to him. And the fact that this is still going on is ludicrous. So for anybody paying attention, we've been scrolling the DOJ comment line across the bottom of the screen. Please go on and leave them. It's a recording. Leave them a message. Tell them to drop the case against Julian Assange. I'm sorry, I digress.
No, it's definitely important. But there is a topic that I think is very important that we do cover in conjunction with what we are talking about. And obviously, we've seen just how out of sight, out of mind it has gotten with the bickering back and forth with, you know, left media. But what Cenk Uygur and Anna Kasparian did to Aaron Mate is unforgivable as far as I'm concerned. I think it was not just reprehensible. I think it's something that should end their program, because when you go down that road, there is no road you won't go down for the right price. And that is the danger of being a journalist. You know, people talk about, well, why didn't Assange just give up his, give up his source? And I'm thinking, because if Assange did give up his source, no matter how bad people may have wanted him to do that, that would have been it. No one would have been able to trust a journal, you know, a reputable outlet ever again to release their information. There would never be another Pentagon Papers type situation or a WikiLeaks type situation. And for, you know, Cenk and Anna to do what they did, especially Anna, I wish people would understand that you got to get Jimmy out of the conversation and just focus on what actually happened here. To attack a journalist in the fashion that they did, I mean, I have no words. I really don't. And I can only imagine, as a journalist like yourself, Jordan Chariton, who is a good friend of mine, friend of the show, obviously shared his sentiments in the same regard. We must protect people who are doing, as you know, the honest work, the work that really matters, especially going out into the field. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, in the same way that I believe we should be clear about Julian Assange, and I don't ever say, whether you think Julian Assange is a journalist or not, and then launch into what I have to say. And when I say Julian Assange is a journalist, it actually matters. It's important to the conversation. It's not something we should concede that it's debatable, because first off, it's factually incorrect that he isn't one, because he's a dues-paying member to the International Federation of Journalists. So, you know, not that you need to have a card to be a journalist. A journalist is something it's an act you perform. You know, you become a journalist when you perform the act of journalism.
And you mean you didn't get your membership card? You didn't get your membership card? I got mine a long time ago. You need to get a card. There's a special card that you have to carry. And if you don't have it, you don't qualify. So I'm just telling
yeah.
you.
Yeah. 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 No, I know Jim Acosta has one. And Luke Harding's got one, too. It means you can lie about things that happened at the Ecuador embassy for the rest of your life and never lose your job at The Guardian. So I think we should be clear. And there's not a whole lot more that needs to be said other than the fact that Aaron Mate, who has been a guest on my show, who I respect, who did award-winning work, digging into the investigation by Special Counsel Robert Mueller, who's done fantastic work staying on top of this thing that has gotten him smeared, the OPCW whistleblower revelations / OPCW scandal around whatever happened in Douma, Syria. He's owed an apology. And it was fair. It was fair for Jimmy Dore to demand an apology. I'll say that much. And there's really not much more that needs to be said. You know, obviously it's metastasized. It's now seems to bring in a whole lot of different players who have expressed their opinions. And then as people believe that those opinions are invalid, then it seems like we're piling on them and suggesting that they're not allowed to engage in the discussion. It's really unfortunate that certain people who have stepped forward to offer their opinions are just getting backlash for, you know, having a view about what went on between the two. But I mean, the basic thing is that he's owed an apology and he still hasn't gotten one. And I think it's fair for him to challenge Anna Kasparian and even Cenk until he gets an apology. And the other problem that they have, which they won't admit, is that they started this and they can't really end it until an apology is offered. So, you know, it's pretty simple.
Maybe if he files a suit against them for slander, then maybe they'll consider retracting their statement, you know, because the reality is that they were making some pretty serious accusations. Now, those of us in the reality world know that that's silly and that they have now fallen the way of like, they might as well be QAnon as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, it's like he actually could have a case if not for the fact that we know it's ridiculous. Right. Like, but what they're saying are legitimate, like, first of all, factual and or not. So that's something that can be proven. So if you're going to call someone out as getting money from somewhere or being on the payroll of someone, then you need to back that up. You know, and obviously they can't because he doesn't, because this is ridiculous.
And I also do think, I mean, this is just my personal opinion. I do think Aaron should sue. And the reason I think he should sue is because we have to put this Russiagate nonsense to bed. It has to go to bed. It has been this was a hatched conspiracy when WikiLeaks dropped the emails from the 2016 primary.
Yeah.
There was always going to be a distraction to make you look in the other direction of what was actually going on. And when you say, well, Aaron is paid by the Russians, that's slander.
Yes.
Slander. And if you can't prove it, then you need to be made an example of.
Yeah.
And they in particular should be made an example of, because so much of what they do is driven by money, no different than corporate media. Jimmy is a bull in a china shop. When he gets his mind set on something, he doesn't let it go, and he's not going to let it go, and he won't let it go until he, you know, sees them basically, you know, dead and buried. I hate saying it that way, but in a way, that's just kind of what it's come to at this point, because they're not going to apologize unless they're forced to. I just don't see that happening. And I think that the whole, you know, again, we are huge fans of Kyle. I think, you know, Secular Talk is one of the best shows that you're going to find. And I think he tried to do the best he could, you know, in terms of a balancing act, but it's just gotten so far out of sight, out of mind at this point. And I do worry about the fracturing that's happening, because we really didn't get involved in any way in this whole mess. We went after Anna. We made her one of our bootlickers of the week, and rightfully so. But the whole drama that has been going on, you know, it and again, the reason why this is now really coming to a head is because Kyle just left TYT. He's no longer affiliated with them. And that is a big deal. And
yeah, so, I agree with our producer, John, who's saying, oh, God, we're still talking about this. I agree. I
just thought it was an important topic to bring up. But thanks for raining on my parade, because I never get
that. I'm so sick of talking about Jimmy Dore. I'm sick of hearing about him.
So then, Jen, you'll appreciate me forwarding the opinion of my dear friend, Rania Kalik, who says that, you know, basically – all these shows, I'm including my own show as well. We spent an hour talking about it one day, but we are all benefiting from this feud. And in fact, some of us, I believe, are monetizing this in a way that is actually distracting from some very real and important issues. So that's a view I simultaneously hold. I think Aaron has a right to do what he's doing, but let me just say, Aaron is fully capable of doing this independently without a lot of assistance from us. I think between Aaron and Jimmy, that they if anyone's going to extract through like a war of attrition, a retraction from Cenk and Anna, it's going to be them.
Yeah, and the last thing I'll mention, and Jen, you're probably not even aware of this, Anna went after Rania the other day. Basically tried to disqualify Rania's basically not doing real journalism, and that she needs to check her sources for the exact words that were used to describe the work that Anna has been doing, Rania has been doing with Breakthrough News. So the idea that, you know, like I said, this isn't going to stop. That's one of the reasons why I felt that it was necessary to bring this up, because Aaron did initially say, yeah, I am actually considering taking legal action, you know, because they threw Assange under the bus, and now they're throwing Aaron under the bus, and now they're throwing Rania under the bus. I mean, at some point, you got to say this is really getting out of hand now. And it is dangerous. Like I said, that's the whole point. And that's the whole point about not speaking up in defense of Julian Assange, regardless of what you think of him as a person, regardless of where it falls politically. There is the slippery slope cannot be overstated in regards to protecting our First Amendment rights and the freedom of speech and the freedom of the press. And that is really what's at hand here. And when I see these other groups, you know, kind of going down that road, it's like, well, there it is. There's the slippery slope. And before you know it, you won't have any rights anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so the problem is basically this tension that's been exposed, where it's the group that's progressive left, except for anywhere outside the United States. You know, it's just like what you see are these people who want to allow any sort of U.S. intervention and interference and meddling and regime change operations, and they aren't willing to question what the military and security agencies are doing in the way that Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning exposed. And that's how we bring it all back to the conversation in which we started, is that these people are profoundly uncomfortable, you know, in the same way that, let's just be really honest here, the same way that Bernie Sanders and AOC and some of the most beloved justice Democrats are uncomfortable with having these conversations, because it just is something in which they can be smeared like this. We see it. And in fact, it's really sad, because what they're doing is exactly what you get from being on corporate media. You would expect for Aaron Maté to go on CNN and be smeared in this way. You would hope that people who were holding themselves out as progressive media would not deploy the same kind of smears.
I think the best way to wrap up the conversation is to basically bring it all the way back to, you know, what is going to be the ultimate result now at this point. I mean, is it really just a matter of time, as far as you can see it, that this is really just a case that they're just going to try to let die without any, basically with a whimper, just like no one's even going to know it happened. They're just going to, you know, there may be some statement that is put out there. I mean, obviously, anyone who has been supporting this issue is going to make a very, very loud statement about it. If ultimately, you know, he's allowed to return to Australia, and whether the charges are dropped or how they're dropped. But where do you see this going? And do you see any type of a time frame at this point?
Yeah, so the U.S. did get granted an appeal, but I didn't get a chance to say very quickly here that they weren't able to contest medical evidence that was given by doctors. They wanted to challenge the credibility of medical experts and say that Julian Assange, if he was in a prison, would not do it because he has a psychiatric condition. And the High Court of Justice said, no, you're not going to challenge the credibility of these experts. The judge did this appropriately. And so now we've got a hearing that's going to come up in the fall, probably, let's say, October. And then that will be a few days. And after that is completed, then Julian Assange will find out if the U.S. government wins. And then it's, it's back in the hands of the Justice Department. Are they going to appeal to the next level? Are they going to take this to a Supreme Court in the UK? So at any moment, as you are telling everyone to call the Justice Department, Biden can drop these charges. Merrick Garland can drop these charges.
Yes,
that's the plain ask. That's all they have to do. But it is the fact, the reality is they are on the losing end. They are losing, and they're not just losing. They're not just losing in the Assange case. They're losing in the entire globe, because here's another thing. They are empowering dictators, because dictators of the world are being interviewed by journalists. And as they raise concerns about press freedom in their own countries, those dictators are saying, so what? How dare you ask me about this? The British government is allowing a journalist to be imprisoned in Belmarsh. And like if an American journalist asks the leader of Azerbaijan, or if someone asks the foreign minister of China about press freedom in their country, they say, don't lecture us on this. Julian Assange is in a prison right now. So we don't have any credibility to tell anybody anything about how they should treat people right now, because we actually have a journalist in jail. And so that's why, you know, if they won't do it because it's wrong, then they should at least do it for the brazen purpose that is making it harder to function as an empire.
If nothing else, I think I just learned for the first time how to say what was it? Say it again.
Azerbaijan.
Yes. And I honestly, I have looked at that for like most of like that I've ever seen it. And I'm like, I don't even try. Azerbaijan. Thank you. That was very informative. Most people have no idea what that is, but
it's a country.
Yeah. Well, I know it's a country, but most people have never heard of it. Couldn't even tell you what continent it's on. I know exactly where it is. I just couldn't have pronounced it, but I'm sorry.
Kevin, where can everybody find you and your work?
I actually have a project of Shadowproof right now called The Dissenter, thedissenter.org. And if you subscribe, you can get access to, it's free. So you can get access to the journalism I'm doing on the Julian Assange case, as well as other whistleblower cases. You know, we don't have time for it right now, but I'm following things like the drone whistleblower Daniel Hale's case, who he's charged under the Espionage Act and will be sentenced at the end of July. So just this is a resource for doing the kind of reporting we don't see in the establishment press.
No, I think it's awesome. And just like how we've talked before, Peter, about how, you know, people have their niche, you know, like Jordan really focuses on like domestic issues that have to do with like, you know, the water and stuff like that. You guys, Kevin is someone who really focuses on whistleblowers and people that are getting prosecuted for speaking truth to power. And this is really important. And I think it's really special that you sort of, I mean, I know you do other stuff too, but that it's such an important topic that other people are not covering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true.
Kevin Gostola of Shadowproof, friend of the show, and he is a real journalist. And we are really appreciative that you came on tonight. And we certainly look forward to having you again on soon, my friend.
Thanks, Kevin. Well,
thank you. You have a good night. Bye.
Take care, buddy.
Thanks for watching. If you want to support our mission to transform politics into service, please like this video, subscribe, follow us on social media, and consider joining our Patreon, where you'll get early access to our interviews as well as other exclusive content. Links are in the description. Peace out.